Okay, this is talking with Dave Williams on 4th June 74 at Hat Creek. So you say that you graduated from the University of Manchester in 51.
Right.
And began as a graduate student then.
Yes.
And what did you first work on?
In the year 1951, the 21 centimeter line, the three papers were published, as you know, simultaneously in Nature, came along, and it was, I guess, a policy decision, a jaw drawbang between Lovell and hierarchy, that one of the grad students would be assigned, essentially, the job of getting an equipment going to study the spectral line, about which essentially nothing was known at that time,
right,
except that it existed.
And so when did you actually begin working? When did you find out about this?
We started building equipment pretty much at that time.
Was it the summer or the fall? Do you remember exactly?
I would say it would be the fall, yes.
Yeah.
Because it would be the fall of 51, I would have started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would think that would be correct, yes.
And what was your goal?
The interesting thing is that the non-documented thing is that, you know, we say, well, okay, it would be nice to study the hydrogen line. The question was, what new aspect of it could we hope to turn up at that point?
Right.
And, you know, how could this be made into something which would be a scientific thesis? And at the time I was working, the first year at the Jodrell Bank, I was working with Gordon Little,
mm-hmm.
now director of the, I don't know what group it is, at Boulder.
Right.
Interestingly enough, he had been involved in ionospheric work at Jodrell Bank. He had just about that time done his thesis on the ionospheric effects of radio stars.
In 51 or 50, they were established that it was the ionosphere.
That's
definitely
right.
Definitely. Yeah.
And Gordon Little had worked out a diffraction theory of the ionosphere,
mm-hmm.
which he got the credit. You see, but the point was this, that he was thinking all the time of signals being absorbed by the ionosphere. And when the 21 centimeter line was detected in the galaxy, his thinking immediately flipped to possibility of this same hydrogen absorbing radio in the line from distant sources, you see.
Right.
Now, nothing was ever said outside Jodrell Bank about that idea. This was parcel of the secrecy that Lovell loved to have around Jodrell Bank. He never told anybody anything, you see. I mean, looking back today, I wouldn't have done, I didn't know how to do it, I wouldn't have played it that way at all, you know. You immediately publish a theoretical paper on, you know, the possibility of detecting this. Instead of which, for several years, must have been two or three years, we struggled along trying to get some equipment together. First of all, A, to detect the hydrogen line, and B, to look at radio sources and see whether we could detect any effect from them. That was our goal at that time.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
It's very interesting, you see, because what happened in history was that at about the point when we were able to say that we had detected an effect, Lilly, Hagen and McLean had accidentally, essentially, with excellent equipment, with a larger telescope than we had at NRL, gone ahead and looked at Cas A and got the deep absorption lines, everything, you see. So in a sense, we were scooped.
Because of this secrecy policy?
It's our own folly, really, you see, in my view.
But now, why did it take you so long? Or did you have to build the antenna also for this?
Yes. The antenna that we had was an old radar antenna that sat on coast of Britain in the war on Beachy Head. It's a 30-foot diameter paraboloid, focal plane paraboloid.
Is this the one that's still, is that Jodrell?
It's probably still there.
Yeah, and that Rod Davies did his thesis on?
Yes, I would think it is. Yes,
yeah.
That would be the one.
I saw that last year, yeah.
Yeah, it's an Alkazimuth mount.
I didn't realize that was the one that you had used, yeah.
Yes, that would have been it. And part of my contribution was to get that, it had a chicken netting surface.
Right.
Was to get a better surface on it, which we did. We got a company who could make expanded metal, which was a great thing in those days. And they expanded copper mesh for us. And we had it carefully laid on the surface and soldered together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but that was quite an expensive undertaking at that time. But it produced a dish which was usable, although very difficult to steer.
Right. It was usable at 21, and the radar had been only a meter wavelength, I guess.
Yes, I think so, yes. Yes. Probably 300 or 400 megasonic.
And did you have to work on the receiver also?
Yes. Rod Davis and I, Rod came in probably in 52, I would think. Yes. More or less coincident with Gordon Little leaving, Rod came along and started to help me. We built the drive for the antenna, the crude analog drive system that enabled you to set a rate in altitude and azimuth so that it could track for short periods of time. Then you corrected the rates,
mm-hmm.
and we put on position readouts, and we started to build the equipment. Using, I had an old American Army surplus signal generator given to me from some company in London, named Peter Gatner, which wouldn't quite tune up to 1400 megahertz. We took it apart, carved bits off the cavity, and finally got it back together and made it work. That was what we used for signal generators.
Amazing.
Yeah. Crude.
But this was the
thing was crude.
This was really the first movable dish at Jodrell, is that true? Or had they been used for meteors before?
Meteor people did have movable arrays of dipoles.
But not parabolic.
The big splash at Jodrell Bank was the transit, the 200 foot.
The hole in the ground.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Wire mesh and the central mast moved. It was quite a long focal length and enabled them to have a ground hazard to make maps with the 1 degree beam meter wavelength. Very impressive at that time.
But was Rod Davies a fellow student, or was he a little bit ahead of you when he was helping you on this project?
He had done some work in Australia, some solo work, I think, after. So he had had some experience in a different field, but switched quite quickly over. He had written some papers on his solo work, and it was overlapped. Then he got interested in the spectral line work with me. And we took it on together from that point.
Okay, so you worked on this from the fall of 51 until about when were you finally on the air?
So the papers were published 54, so it would be probably about 6 months prior to that,
and
I would think.
So what was the procedure once you got on the air? You first just detected emission?
Yes.
Trying to repeat the Dutch results. Of course, all this time now, the Dutch had been, you knew that they were going through a whole survey of the galaxy.
Right, exactly, yes. We were looking at them.
And the Australians also were surveying the southern galaxy.
Yes, right. The Dutch had come out with a lot of the profiles that we were able, as you point out, to repeat right away as soon as we got going. Essentially the same size telescope. But we were always impressed by the refined way in which the Dutch did their work. Beautiful profiles.
The baselines
were marvelous compared to ours at that time. And their singleness of purpose was very impressive to us.
Yeah, that's Orton Mueller. Yeah.
Mm, yes, right.
I've talked to them, it's in the data that comes through. So you detected the emission, and then did you immediately look at Cass, I suppose, the strongest source around?
I think pretty soon, yes. As soon as possible, we started to look at Cass, Cygnus, and Taurus, I guess.
And by this time, had you...
I'm not sure Taurus was known as a radio source then, yeah.
Oh, yes, it was. In 48, Bolton, already Bolton had it.
But, yes, but not at 21 centimeters.
Oh,
21 centimeters.
No, that was just about that was just about at 54, yeah.
Yes.
And once again at NRL, yeah. That was first detected, yeah.
Yes.
Let's see. So you, right from the in 51, you were working all this time, and everyone's working hydrogen. Yet you're going along and going to do absorption. By the time you did it, had you already fully expected that you might see a couple features in absorption due to spiral arms and so forth, or was that a surprise when you had the final profile?
I think we had always hoped that we would, find absorption in near, the nearby spiral arms, and maybe not in the outer ones.
It seems from the paper that you had in mind it as a distance determination method. In your paper,
yes.
In Nature.
Yeah, that was that's true. That's the way it reads, I know.
But was this only after you got the observations, or was that the idea as you went along? Do you remember?
I think it was embodied in the idea. I think that by the amount of absorption that one should be able to
rather than the velocity of the absorption feature, because that was an idea that was only beginning to come in. Or was it?
Yeah, I think that was also in there. Certainly at that time, the distance away of the radio sources was the big unknown.
Right.
Really.
Right.
And then, of course, there was this also in the case of Cass, there was this big conflict with Bader Minkowski. Who had by then detected the filaments. There was a conference at Jodrell Bank, I don't know.
Right, that was 54 also.
Was that 54
yeah.
also, which yes, in which the big conflict
I've seen the
was,
thing at observatory on that. Hanbury Brown had a report on that.
Oh,
conference.
Yes.
Right, because Minkowski thought it was only at a half a kiloparsec or something.
Yes, 500 parsecs was their feeling, and they disregarded the 21 centimeter absorption.
Right.
Or would like to have disregarded it.
Do you have any idea why that might have been? I'm hoping to talk to Minkowski this coming weekend if I can get to him. But
yes.
Do you think this was just not understanding the data, or why? Because here was one of the few optical astronomers that really was paying attention to the low frequency continuum anyway. Why was he ignoring another part of the radio data?
You'd have to argue, I just forget, but it was a powerful argument against it being at a greater distance than that. Whether it had to do with the whether the energetics or...
I see. So it was an astrophysical
velocity
argument. Velocity? That he just didn't want to believe.
They felt that...
I think it was the very high velocities.
Yeah.
If you had the proper motions.
Yes.
If you put it farther away, that meant a very much higher kinematic velocity.
Did they have the proper motions at that time, possibly? Yes.
I think they did.
Yes, that would have been it then.
And it was much more than they'd seen in other supernovae.
Yes,
or at least without the preconception was of what a supernova should do.
Also, I suspect that they felt that at a much greater distance,